All right, big homie, you ready?
Yes, sir.
Right, now we live. So I will get this started with, let me find this. What your video you wanted?
Oh, you mean on the it's the very last one for the song. It's the very, very last one in the thread.
Is it a Malcolm X?
No, it's Bob Marley.
I do not see this. I don't see
Don't.
it. No. I get it. I take care of it though. No worries. No worries at all. Sorry about that, y'all. I will have this just a second.
Let me check for my phone.
What's the
I
name
did
of the
add it to
song?
my phone.
Name of the song?
Oh, what? There it is. It's coming up now. I thought I pressed the send. It should be in there now. Just refresh the screen. I never got it. I thought it went through. I probably just brushed the button.
Once again, apologies for that. Let's go. Welcome to real life.
Flop, yeah. And during the few moments that we have left, we want to have just an off-the-cuff chat between you and me. Us. We want to talk right down to earth in a language that everybody here can easily understand.
Show. I am your host, Jenna Kepra, alongside my co-host, Brother Roz. Today is May 28th, 2019. Hope this reaches you at a comfortable space in your life and today. Best wishes to you all. Brother Roz, how are you doing tonight?
Hey, greetings to you. Greetings to all the calls and listeners. I'm still learning. How you doing?
Still learning, man. It's a steady flow. A steady flow of new lessons.
Absolutely.
Tiring.
Yeah. I always say learn. Try to learn something new within every 24 hours. So
man, and it's so easy. It's just about if you want to know what you find out learning. But let's get on to tonight's show. Tonight's show is outside circumstances, which will be directly affected by ignoring the consequences of reality. We have a lot of things to discuss tonight. Where would you like to start, Ross?
Well, I know you said you had some things you wanted to talk about, so I think we'll run through those, and then from there, we could go into, I guess, a couple of clips, and then we'll go into the other part of the conversation.
Okay, well, let me get a refresh. Found this on Vice. And this was published May 15th, vicenews.com. Kansas has to pass a law to tell cops they can't have sex with people they're arresting. And I'm going to just go in just a little brief excerpt out of the article. Kansas just became the 18th state to make it illegal for cops to have sex on the job. Kansas police officers are now specifically forbidden from having sex with someone during a traffic stop, for example, while they're interrogating someone in custody or doing an interview in a criminal investigation. According to the bill, Kansas Governor Jeff Caller signed into law last week, Republican Cindy Hosha told the Wichita Eagle that she has introduced a bill in response to allegations of sexual abuse in a police investigation into a wrongful murder conviction. Affidavits in the case allege that over decades, retired white homicide detective Roger Gabowski repeatedly threatened to arrest black women or their family members unless they had sex with him. Hosha told the Eagle that her decision to introduce the bill was also driven by a case in New York City last September where two NYPD police officers allegedly raped an 18-year-old woman in their police van after they arrested her on marijuana charges. The rape kit matched both officers' DNA, but they claimed the sex was consensual. The case is ongoing and the judge has so far declined to drop charges against the officers. The article is in our thread. I thought that was very significant to note. And I have to refresh again, but what it made me do is go find out what other states have not, that this isn't illegal already in. So there's more states that is not illegal than it is. So that's one thing. And like I said, you can find this in the thread at BTR Community under Foundational Radio. Let's see what this next one is I want to get into real quick. Here we go. 50 Cincinnati cops vowed to, excuse me, let me not say that. Those are my words. But Dayton Ku Klux Klan rally anticipates 20 Klansmen, 1,000 protesters. I'm trying to find the name of this because this is hilarious how they described it. They described it as 50 Cincinnati cops will back up Dayton PD at the Klan rally. So this is going on right now. Here lately there's been talk about, and not on this network or nothing, but just different news outlets, whether it's mainstream or your alternative. People have been talking as if this is in the past. They speak of it in past tense. So this is happening right now. Slave catchers still supporting the Klan as if some of the people they protecting aren't related, or they could just swap uniforms. So be wary of this, and make sure you pay attention to when there's a Klan rally in your area. And I think those was the only two that I wanted to get out. I was interested in a few that you put up there, Roz, but I'm going to let you introduce those, and I'll follow along.
But which ones were they?
Well, this David Banner joint, for one. Kind of, I
the
had
cartoon?
To check this. No, or no. This what he just speaking about some stuff that we done talked about several times.
Okay.
On and off.
Okay.
Earth. So you want to start there?
Before we do that, I just wanted to correct something from earlier today, just to get that done.
What are we talking about?
Oh, I'm talking about from earlier on Tando.
Okay.
Yeah. I just wanted to make a correction. I was talking on Tando today. And I said that there were companies that were using aborted baby fetuses in their food products. So this was something we had talked about like 2 years ago, if I remember correctly, Jenna. And it wasn't fresh in my mind, so I just spoke off of just what I thought I remembered. So Scotty had actually asked me for some more information about it. So once I looked it up, I just reviewed the information again. And ultimately, they do not use the aborted human fetuses in their food products. What they did was they created these special robots, and they take the aborted fetal cells and they create tongues. Actually, or these cells they use to create what would be the equivalent of a human tongue that they put on a robot. And it is designed to sense the taste buds and how they would respond the same way a living human tongue would respond.
Can I interject for a brief second? Isn't
sure.
Those are the stem cells, if I'm not mistaken, that change into any cell that's available? Is that correct?
These cells are called HEK23. They're actually human fetal kidney cells.
Okay.
The stem cells are used. Actually, they do use baby fetus products, and that does include stem cells in cosmetic products and in vaccinations, including like measles, mumps, rubella, and a whole bunch of other ones. So they actually do use aborted fetal parts in those two things, but they don't use them specifically in food. They take these HEK23, which are the kidney cells. They grow them in a petri dish, and then they put them on a robot. and it's designed to sense the sweet and salty senses on your tongue. So what it does is they make these chemicals that they call flavor enhancers, and they put the flavor enhancer on those cells, and it reacts the same way that a human tongue would. So it makes sure that only the receptors for salty or sweet are triggered. And then based on that, they know that when you buy that bag of Cheetos, it's going to taste the same every time. Now, the thing about it that, so in other words, they said that they do not use the human fetal cells in any of the final products, but it's used in the process to make sure that the flavor is exactly the same whenever they're making whatever mass-produced processed food that is. Now, the thing about it, though, they did stipulate was that because it is not it's not labeled as a flavor or a flavor additive, that the company's called Cinnamon. And this is S-E-N-O-M-I-N. And with the company, they were just bought out by a company called Firmenich, which is like the global company that creates all the flavors, the vast majority of flavors for most of the companies that make different food items. They buy their flavor enhancers and flavor, some of their flavors directly from Firmenich, which is actually a Jersey company. And what it is that the thing about it is because it's legally listed as a flavor enhancer, they do not have to tell the public what specific ingredients are in these flavor enhancers. They said that it only appears under the broad title of artificial flavors. So if you buy, let's say, I'm just using Cheetos as an example, and it says natural and artificial flavors, those artificial flavors are made of these chemicals that are mysterious, because legally the company does not have to divulge what is in those chemicals. So it's something unnatural. And regardless of what the ingredients are, they do not legally have to divulge it. So that's where the ambiguity is, because they claim that no human fetal cells are used in the final product, but yet legally they don't have to tell you what is in that flavor enhancer. And what they said that the flavor enhancer does is it allows them to make products with less sodium and less sugar, but it fools your tongue into believing that you're eating something sugary or something salty. So in other words, it's fooling your sensors. And it works like a lock and key mechanism. So it's only designed to trigger off the parts of your tongue that taste salty and sweet. The bitter part of your tongue or any of the other taste receptors, it actually closes those off to you and only allows you to taste either salty or sweet or a combination of the two, depending on what product it is that you're putting in your mouth. So that's where the ambiguity goes, is that they don't have to tell you what's in these quote-unquote flavor enhancers, because it's not labeled as an ingredient. It's just labeled under what they call the broad title of artificial flavors. Whatever artificial flavors may mean to you, it can be anything. So that's pretty much the way that it was put. So I just wanted to make that correction, because I know that I've definitely heard a lot of people, and there's quite a few YouTube videos with people. And it's weird, because even with the articles, a lot of the articles out there explicitly state that they use aborted fetuses in your food products. And then when you go deeper into the article, they further qualify it by saying it's used in the process of creating the flavor. And then they break down that whole thing I just explained about the human fetal kidney cells that they cultivate into these tongues that they can use to taste test their products before they release it to the public. But they actually do use aborted fetal cells in your vaccinations. And they said that there are other types that they call ethically sound, meaning that they don't use aborted fetal body parts. You'd have to recommend those specific vaccinations, and they also definitely use them in cosmetic products. And you'll even see on some of the products, it'll say even human placenta, or they'll say placenta, which is actually a human placenta. So they have it there and listed in there as far as that's concerned, but they don't actually tell you, oh, we use aborted baby products in it, but they actually do. And that's something that the CDC is fully aware of. There was a great article that had like links to PDFs and everything with the CDC discussing the fact that they do allow the use of those things in cosmetics.
Yeah, you throw those in the thread as well.
Oh, okay, I'll definitely put them in there, because it was actually a thread Scotty and I were having a discussion on, and I just said, well, I wanted to make sure that I put that correction out there, because I don't want any misinformation floating around. And for those people who might have heard of or seen some of these things, these YouTube videos and some of these articles, especially if you're not reading through the whole thing. And like I said, we haven't talked about this in a couple of years, so it wasn't fresh in my mind. But I just wanted to make sure that everybody had that correct, that they explicitly state they do not use it in the final product, but it definitely is used in the process of making sure they get to the correct tasting final product. That's it. So that was what I wanted to get into. I think we could definitely go into the David Banner video. I think that's a really good one. After that, I think you should go for the next one, which is the American Gods piece.
Okay, I have to go in there and find it. But before we do that, I wanted to run. This is another one that I had wanted to get in about because you brought it up with the fetal.
Yes, with
the
go ahead.
Fetus. Excuse me. Thousands of they splashing this all over mainstream media as well. Thousands of kindergartners going unvaccinated without waivers. And I ain't going to, they just putting this out there as a scare tactic because they done gave us measles. When I say us, I mean the nation. So let me clear that. But they have gave the nation the measles again and using this as an excuse. There has been, in I can't find the article right now. I was trying to look it up, but I can't find the exact one that I was reading. But one of the researchers has stated that they don't know how many kindergartners it is because they never kept up with the records. So if they never kept up with
the records, so they're really trying to scare the public. They're basically saying you don't know how many people have it. There's at least 1,000, and we don't even have the records to let you know what the deal is. So it's really like a scare tactic. It really is.
So
that's what it seems like to me. I could be incorrect.
You made me think about that when you was talking about the all the different places the fetal cells are going, and also it's that time of year. A lot of people are getting sick because of these vaccines. Just keep up on this information. And this article, this comes from APnews.com, and they report about it quite often, actually. So I just want to throw that in there before we move forward.
Oh, yeah, they do. They did just come out with an article on the Silver Edge where there's two of them. One that stated that table salt is more toxic than colloidal silver and that there's a lunatic fringe that keeps talking about the condition known as erygia, which is blue skin, from people who ingest way too much colloidal silver, which is an extremely rare condition. It is not something that happens to any and everybody. Silver is one of the safest things that you can take. And they talk about it in those two articles. One's called Colloidal Silver and the Lunatic Fringe, which is a really good article. The other one is called Table Salt or Colloidal Silver, which one is more toxic. And then there's another one that came out with an actual scientific study that showed that colloidal silver beats superbugs or drug-resistant bacteria and drug-resistant viruses and things of that nature. So actually, that's in the health section in BTR community as well. And actually, I sell colloidal silver. So if anybody's interested in getting some, I sell it in 16-ounce bottles. They're in BPA-free so that it doesn't leach any chemicals. There's special bottles that don't leach any chemicals into it at all. It's just 40 parts per million colloidal silver in 16-ounce bottles. So if anybody's interested, just reach out to me at raskelile@comcast.net, and we'll be able to, you know, talk to you further and get it moving if that's what you're looking for. But also, the main thing to remember is that if you do keep colloidal silver around, it is the world's first and the most potent natural antibiotic you can take. And it's not something you can ever take too much of because it's not based on genetics. How it works is that the silver nanoparticles actually smother the cell. So that's what makes it so effective. There's no way that any sort of bug can genetically mutate above silver's ability to kill it because it just chokes the cell to death. So that's how it works on a scientific cellular level. So that's one of the main reasons to keep it around, as well as it helps with so many things from skin ailments and rashes, healing cuts exponentially quick, and pretty much even extending the life of your food. You wanted to extend the life of your fruits and vegetables, spray it with some silver. You could also use hydrogen peroxide in a similar fashion. Wash your fruits and vegetables with hydrogen peroxide as well, and that'll help to prevent the different microorganisms that cause your fruit to break down within a certain time frame. It can actually extend the life by not allowing those microorganisms to actually start propagating on the skin of the fruit, which eventually causes what we know as the rotting process. So Yeah, just wanted to toss that out there.
Well, yeah, and also wash your fruit and your vegetables because they spray chemicals on there to keep them looking fresh. So be weary of that. good wash in warm water should wash the film off. It'll disgust you once you see it the first time. Oh, but yeah, but continue.
So these are the ones I wanted to do. The David Banner one, the one after it, the American God clip. The other one is the Malcolm X one, Learn to Think for Yourself. And then there's two more. One is Colonial Languages Have Taken Away Your Power. And then the last one is The Cognitive Trade-Off Hypothesis. Because that'll lead into the other stuff we're going to talk about. So I just wanted to talk about it. I'll get that going first.
Okay. Well, I see the American God piece.
Yes, right after David Banner.
You want the Malcolm X one that's right up under the American
God. Right, it says Learn to Think for Yourself. That's the one. It should be right after that, I believe. Let me just go back and look.
Well, there's a couple of them. So I found it. I got it. So, okay. We'll get.
Okay. And then the other two are together. That's the Colonial Languages Have Taken Away Your Power. And then the Cognitive Trade-Off Hypothesis. And stop that one at 11 minutes or 15 seconds exactly. Because that's showing everything that I needed to say would be done.
Okay.
All right. Okay, cool.
Morning. Just wanted to make a comment and something for us to think about. I watch our people, you know, every day become more and more like the people that we complain about. I watch the shit that people say. And the things that our people do. And because of the internet, it gives us a sense of comfort to do really savage shit and to say savage shit. You know. Just some shit we don't do from a culture perspective, but the more we become or we walk more and more towards being totally integrated into white society, I watch us, you know, really, like Franz Fanon said, be black-skinned with a white mask. You know, when you have a death of a person, we all have to realize that they have families and cousins and friends who see the things that you post and the things that you say. I remember one time telling this lady back at the local news in Mississippi, I remember telling her, watch your fucking mouth, dude. My grandma watched the news. Yeah, watch the shit that you say, man. My grandmother and my cousins and shit, like, fuck whether it's true or false, you have to have a level of respect about something, you know? And I'll give you a quick example. When Pimp C died, people would always ask me, what did I think happened? And I told them I don't fucking care what happened. My friend is dead, dude. You know, the other shit don't really matter to me. And we argue back and forth about our opinions, and then we forget the most human side of the fact that give people a chance to mourn. Should you mourn if you care as much? If it makes you want to argue about shit, you ain't even mourning. You ain't even taking time to mourn. And be human. You know, the other side of it is people argue back and forth what things are Well, 9 times out of 10, most people ain't gonna do shit anyway. Regardless of whether you right or wrong. Okay, let's say you right on this side. All right, once you admit that you right, what the fuck you gonna do? Nothing. If you right on the other side, what you gonna do? Nothing. We gotta stop acting like them, man. You know, it's funny, most of the time y'all hear me, I'm sitting on the porch like our grandparents. Just trying to get back to some of the ways, you know, our great grandparents and our parents used. And we're so quick to move forward. Everybody is thrusting so hard to move forward. To be honest with you, I'm trying to go back. You know, if you look at the concept of Sankofa, in order to move forward, you have to grasp the past. The past dictates the type of future you're going to have anyway. And we have no concept of who we are, for the most part, as Africans in America. Or whatever y'all choose to believe. It's always a fucking argument. Whatever. It's funny, even with that, whatever we are, we fucked up. So whatever you believe, it ain't changing shit. You feel me? But I don't know, man. We losing our humanity, man. And I think we could do better.
I am not a god in the sense that I can tolerate exploitation, oppression, and repression. My worshipers know freedom ain't free. They know the most potent weapon of control for the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. They know slavery is not a condition. Slavery is a cult. Human trafficking is a cult. Slavery got a rebrand like motherfucking the alt-right. And snatched. Another one gone. Every 30 seconds, another chocolate, brown, caramel, yellow, high yellow, red bone refugee girl with melanin in her skin gets snatched. Every 30 seconds. And to make matters worse, these dazzling new plantation owners built a pipeline to take our children from school to prison quicker than a cut can bleed. And the lucky ones go from school to the NFL, where they don't even let them niggas take a knee. They've been programmed from birth with shitty food options, contaminated drinking water, gun violence, police brutality, and trauma after trauma after trauma. PTSD, no therapy. Missing, no Amber Alert. Alone. Snatched. Another one gone.
I hear you, brother.
Man. So I'm moving a little slow.
Oh, I am very pleased. Also, I am very pleased to see so many who have come out to always see for yourself, where you can hear for yourself and then think for yourself. Then you'll be in a better position to make an intelligent judgment for yourself. But if you form the habit of listening to what others say about something or someone, or reading what someone else has written about someone, somebody can confuse you and misuse you. Others say about something or someone, or reading what someone else has written about someone, somebody can confuse you and misuse you. So as Afro-Americans or black people here in the Western Hemisphere, you and I have to learn to weigh things for ourselves. No matter what the man says, you better look into it. An example of why it's so important to look into things for yourself. I was on a plane between Algiers and Geneva, and it just happened that two other Americans were sitting in the two seats next to me. None of us knew each other. And the other two were white, one a male, the other a female. And after we had been flying along for about 40 minutes, the lady, she says, could I ask you a personal question? I said, yes. She said, well, she had been looking at my briefcase, and she said, well, what does that X? She says, what kind of last name could you have that begins with X? So I said, that's it, X. And she said, well, what does the M stand for? I said, Malcolm. So she was quiet for about 10 minutes. And she turned to me and she says, you're not Malcolm X. You see, we had been riding along in a nice conversation like three human beings, you know, no hostility, no animosity, just human. And she couldn't take this. She said, well, you're not who I was looking for, you know? And she ended up telling me that she was looking for horns and all that and for someone who was out to kill all white people, as if all white people could be killed. This was her general attitude, and this attitude had been given her, this image had been given her by the press. So before I get involved in anything nowadays, I have to straighten out my own position. And which is clear, I am not a racist in any form whatsoever. I don't believe in any form of racism. I don't believe in any form of discrimination or segregation. I believe in Islam. I'm a Muslim.
Okay.
Welcome to Tunacheki, the best source of African lists, entertainment, pop culture, and news. Today we have a very special video courtesy from the Economic Commission for Africa. We will be talking about the Africa Continental Free Trade Agreement.
If
you have any interest in a United Africa, one Africa.
My apologies.
Also, right, it's the one about colonial languages is taking your power, and the one after it. If we could just get past all of her intro music and just get to her actually talking. But yeah, that's okay. The one. That one and the one after it.
I got you.
Okay.
Hey family, what's up? Welcome to another episode of Wake Up Africa, where we want to talk more about the awakening that is happening in our people, but kind of putting a narrative to it and kind of, giving some pointers on how individually you can awaken yourself, align yourself, and move into a position of power internally. And, you know, because we are spiritual beings having a physical experience. I've said that so many times. And what happens is that we live in a mental reality. So, you know, even the scriptures, as much as they've been doctored, there's a lot of nuggets of truth there. The hint at the nature of this world and the nature of reality. And we're told in the beginning was the Word. So everything came from the Word. You know, whatever creative beings, you know, the Most High Creator, the Elohim, the group of, you know, super intelligent beings, whatever, they used sound to create. And we have been, you know, created in their image, which means that our words also have a lot of power. And the reason we've been disenfranchised from ourselves is because we have taken on another man's paradigm of reality by adopting their language. Now, that that is not only just, you know, that's why Africa has been enslaved on the outside of things. So when you look at the outside reality, that's why people, you know, that's why Africa remains in bondage. Because, you know, some people say Africa was named Africa before. I'm not going to get into those details. But the fact that Africa is named after Africanus means that the frequency of Africa, you know, and he wasn't given that name, General Africanus, which basically meant like the conqueror of this land. And so we keep that frequency by continuing to call ourselves Africa, etc. So that's what happened externally. But what happened inside us? What does the fact that we speak another language mean to the internal workings of our system? Because if words are the keys to reality, if words are the building blocks to reality, and we're not speaking the words of our ancestors, and they were the original beings, then that explains why we totally lack power. Now, someone had actually written to me last week, and they said that the main thing that has happened is that the British language has no rhythm. Okay, the Germanic, because, you know, it's taken its roots from the German language. It has no rhythm. And because it has no rhythm and the sound is kind of different, it has that frequency has totally removed us from our reality and put us in another frequency that takes us out of the conscious flow of the earth. I hope I'm not losing you guys. I hope I'm really making a lot of sense. So now what has happened in us, and this is what they say. They say when we, you know, before we were created, we were just free creators, let's say. As when we were born, when we were existing, we were free creators. And there's so much that has been hidden about the powers our people operated in, the fact that they could even speak telepathically to one another, how they communicated, etc., etc., and how they communicated with the other beings that we share this planet on, because we're not the only ones here. Those are stories for other days. So what they say is learning English, and first of all, learning to read and write, locked down our minds and shut us down from the other internal voice. But what we need to realize is that that knowledge is still in there, and that original language is still in there. Even if you were born and raised and you speak another language and you've never heard it, you know they're speaking in tongues. It's actually not that mystical. There's some much deeper vibrations there. So the basic thing that I want you guys to know is that all the power is in you. But you cannot access that power in you because you're not speaking your internal language. And writing actually activated another part of your brain. Because you see, also, when we used to write, it would be written from like left to right, which would mean it would go into memory and then we'd create. But now right to left, it's like it would go in from the creative into memory. But now the way we write from left to right, actually it kind of indoctrinates us or puts memory and then the creative process. So we're already told how to think, how to act, how to behave. So what you need to do is you need to find ways to establish an inner dialogue with yourself, to tap into that inner voice so that you can tap into the inner reality, because there's so much that is happening inside of you. And what is happening inside of you is being reflected outside of you. You know, you have a Google, an entire Google system inside you. You have every answer inside of you, but you've been locked out of yourself. That's why they say a lot of Africans, we're out of our minds, because we're out, we've been locked out. We don't even have the knowledge of, you know, when the body is sick. People know how to even, the elders even knew how to talk to different various organs and kind of resuscitate and like elevate that system. So we've totally gone out of that. Every answer is inside of us, but as long as we continually seek things outside of us, that voice gets dulled down. And so I really, really want to encourage you guys to get into a daily routine and a daily practice. Some call it meditation, some call it just being in silence, where you start to exchange, you know, start having an inner conversation and asking those questions that you really want answered. Stop looking outside for answers. Start seeking within. Whether you do it through prayer, through meditation, that's the line you need to go into. Because there is nothing outside of this world that is more powerful than what you have in your heart and in your mind. up here, this is what you have, and continuously seek your awakening, continuously put it out there in the atmosphere. I intend to awaken. I intend to ascend. I shall know the truth, and the truth shall set me free. Recognize the power of I am. And like the I am words that you say about yourself, I am brilliant, I am great. You know, a guy say do the positive affirmations, but go deeper with that. I am the creator of my experience. So if I am the creator of my experience, why am I creating sorrow for myself? All the answers are inside you, my brothers and sisters. There's a Google right inside of you where you just need to put and they'll give you everything. It'll give you all the answers that you need from life. I pray that you will start to tap in to the power that is just dormant inside of you, and that you will start to transform your life, your peace, your mind. Stay blessed. Wake up, wake up, wake up, wake up, wake up, wake up, wake up. Wake up, Africa.
This is Inuyama, Japan, a historic city home to Japan's oldest original wooden castle. It is also home to Kyoto University's Primate Research Institute. Here, a group of chimpanzees have been trained to play a game that exposes something shocking about their memories. This is going to blow your mind. Here is how it works. Take a look at these numbers. 1, 2, 3. Remember where they are, because they're about to disappear. Can you point to where each number used to be in numerical order? Probably, it's pretty easy. 1, 2, 3. But what if we make it harder? Get ready to point to where each number was in order now. If you feel like you didn't have enough time to memorize the screen, that's fine. It's nothing to be ashamed of. Or is it? Here is a chimpanzee taking exactly that long to memorize the same arrangement. Nailed it. Each of these puzzles is completely new to the chimpanzee, but just a glance is all it needs to completely capture all the numbers. How can a chimpanzee's memory be so much better than ours? Well, one theory is that we humans are worse at this task because we can talk. What makes humans different from other animals? Well, one thing is language. We have the cognitive ability to communicate not just about what's happening now, but also about what did happen and what could happen. We can tell stories, and it's awesome. But if language is so good, why didn't any other animal develop it like we did? A good approach to this question is one that looks at how we are different from those who were almost us. Around 7 million years ago, there were no chimpanzees and there were no humans, but there were CHULCAs, an acronym which stands for Chimpanzee Human Last Common Ancestor. Like us, CHULCAs didn't have great natural offenses or defenses like blistering sprint speeds, protective shells, or claws, fangs, or venom. So, living in the safety of the trees was great. Those who stayed became the chimps we know today. But for reasons we're still not quite sure of, some of the CHULCAs decided to venture down to the savanna. Without appropriate physical abilities, things like cooperation, imagining new strategies, and the assigning of roles were necessary for survival. All of which are easier if you have a rich collection of symbols that can refer to things across time. Language. Many different types of creatures emerged with varying adaptations, but today, only one member of the family remains, us. Language, as we know it, may have been one of the strategies that kept us alive in the savanna. But where did it move in? The brains of those who developed language, And those who didn't aren't totally different. A brand new brain structure didn't just pop into existence. Instead, anatomy used for other tasks must have been sacrificed. And as it turns out, for beautiful reasons, detailed, short-term memory may have been a fair thing to lose in return for language. This trade-off between memory and language is the cognitive trade-off hypothesis. The cognitive trade-off hypothesis is the culmination of decades of work by one of the world's leading primatologists, Professor Tetsuro Matsuzawa of Kyoto University's Primate Research Institute. Founded in 1967, the institute was created for scientific research in association with the nearby Japan Monkey Center. The collaborative centers house over 60 species and nearly 1,000 primates who live and play in open spaces.
Look at monkeys. Look at spider monkey.
Is there a baby on that one?
Yes, 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 yes. 6 months old baby.
6 months?
Yes. Showing the monkeys and apes in the tree.
Yeah.
High in the tree. That is the key. Because they live.
That's where they live.
In their natural habitat.
Can you do it? Dr. Matsuzawa has spent over 40 years researching non-human primates. He splits his time between fieldwork in the West African country of Guinea and here in Japan, where he and his colleagues have developed a chimpanzee habitat designed to mimic life in the wild. This habitat is home to Skylab, a working laboratory set high atop the chimpanzee's climbing structure. In this open-air lab, chimpanzees are free to come and go as they please.
And this is
Hayumu.
This is Hayumu. Mm.
If they decide to stay, they participate in cognitively enriching tasks designed to mimic foraging behavior. When the chimpanzees are interested in participating, they enter one of Skylab's specially designed computer booths where a camera uses facial recognition software to recognize them and select a test based on that particular chimp's current familiarity with the task. Each trial takes about as long as it would for a chimp to forage a single bite, and each morsel of food they get is accounted for in their diet.
Do the doors open when they approach? No human even needs to be...
No, nothing.
So what is for us a great way to collect data is for them an experience similar in many ways to what they would be doing in the wild.
There you go.
Impressive.
Dr. Matsuzawa has been running memory tests like these on chimpanzees since 1978. His research has shown the phenomenal and nearly photographic short-term memory of these primates. Two of the most famous chimps at the PRI are Ai, named after the Japanese word for love, and her son, Ayumu, whose name means walk. What can we learn about ourselves by studying chimpanzees like them? Well, I want to find out.
If we and chimpanzees come from a common ancestor, what can explain the split where the chimpanzees don't seem to need or to develop language like we did? Why would that happen? Was it an accident?
The various evidence tells us chimpanzee was so strong and continued to stay in the forest. We humans were not so strong. We were kicked out from the forest.
Uh-huh.
And coming down to the ground to go into the dangerous open land where lions, cheetahs, and those carnivorous creatures, we protect ourselves from the predator.
Our habitat provided a pressure to develop language.
Yes. We have to collaborate each other. Hmm. So, as a group.
That's incredible.
Hmm.
So, in a way, we should be really grateful that our ancestors were so weak they got pushed out of the trees.
We have succeeded to show extraordinary memory capability of chimpanzees. He is protesting. Bam, 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 bam.
I'd invite you to be a part of this interview, but you don't have language.
He doesn't need to have the language. So chimpanzee mainly live in the world of here.
Right now.
And now. Suppose that something happened in the bush. You have to count up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, how many enemies there to make a quick decision to go into the territory or leave.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the life of chimpanzees.
Quick decision.
Quick decision.
Our ancestors didn't have that same pressure.
In the course of human evolution, we may have had this kind of capability, but we lost it to gain the new function, the language. Maybe memory and the language, the very rudimental form, was located in neighboring parts of the brain. So to expand one area, another one must be shrunk. So putting all those things together to postulate my trade-off hypothesis of language and memory.
The cognitive trade-off hypothesis suggests that in the dangerous world beyond the trees, early humans needed to teach each other and use abstract symbols that could refer not just to the immediate here and now, but to hypotheticals and generalities. Making room for that kind of abstract thinking meant sacrificing the immediate and detailed memory of their ancestors.
I can think about the future of my child and their children.
Yeah.
Chimpanzee do not have this kind of planning of the future. So the difference, in one word, is imagination.
I'm able to imagine past and future.
And
I'm able to describe things in an abstract way.
And I don't want to have just an awesome cup.
Because I have the label. So it seems like a pretty good trade-off.
Yes. But how do we use the power of imagination? Is for sharing.
Yeah.
Helping each other, collaborating each other to raise the children.
Yeah.
I understand chimpanzee mind so that now I understand the unique feature of human mind, and that is sharing.
What a great message, right? Mm. Sharing is what makes us us.
Yes. Sharing is the matter.
I would love to see your working memory tests on chimpanzees in action.
Sure.
Man. I'm interested in which way you're going with this, Roz, but before we do, you want to go on and give out the number to the listeners?
Sure. you are now live on Real Life, the radio show with myself, Roz, and my co-host, Jenna Kepra, on Foundational Radio Network via Black Talk Radio Network. If you do wish to call in and ask a question or make a comment, please give us a call at 719-284-5271. Again, that's 719-284-5271. And the code is 70637. Press *61 if you wish to comment or ask a question. Yes. So what's interesting about this is, first, I'll go back to David Banner. And David Banner just said some really powerful things just in regards to how we treat each other and how, like Dave always says on Panda Radio, we've become what we've had to endure. And a lot of us use the same terroristic white supremacist practices that the colonizer used on us, on each other. And just to the point where we don't even just respect even when people pass away. And I could tell he kind of addressed the self-identity issues that a lot of us have, when he said, whatever you choose to call yourself today, because it's, even that's an argument, and it's still not going to change anything. You know, we argue about things that, like he said, in the larger scheme of things, isn't going to change things unless you as a person are seeking to grow in some way. And a lot of people aren't. They're just seeking to be right. And as a result, you have people locked into certain ways of thinking and certain personality traits that go along with that way of thinking that's usually negative. And they're just so convinced that whatever it is that they believe and they think is correct is correct. There's no room for anything else. I've always said that. You can't pour anything into a full cup. So if a person you're having a conversation with is just immutable and they're not able to take in and digest something that you're talking about to maybe expand their consciousness, understand that their knowledge cup is full. And there's no room for anything else to enter it until they choose to, if they ever choose to, pour some of what's in it out to make room for something new. And a lot of people are locked in that frame of mind for a lifetime. So that's why I say I don't waste time dealing with crazy. As soon as a person shows those kind of traits, I immediately just cease and desist the conversation if it's something that's going in that direction, and usually try to just vacate the conversation completely if it can't change to something that's going to be constructive. So I thought that was powerful. Malcolm X talking about learning to think for yourself, and the fact that this white woman thought he was just this gruesome monster that wanted to kill every white person on sight. And when she got to have a civilized, normal conversation with him, she said, "I was expecting someone else," because she was so successfully cultivated by mainstream media to see him as this deadly, white-hating pariah that's the monster that you conjure up is always worse than the monster you see, which is not really a monster. It is just like you use a child's imagination to make them think there's a monster under the bed. And you could see it in the child's face that they're completely terrified and they don't want to go in their bed by themselves because they think that monster that you forced them to think about is going to come up from under the bed and kill them or attack them or hurt them in some way. And then they realize there's no monster under the bed. It's the same sort of thing. It's just that this is an adult. And it also shows you something that Gus has talked about numerous times on the cows, that white people pay attention to everything. The conversation started with her minding his business and watching the initials on his briefcase. And her being an intelligent white woman, knowing the history of black people and the fact that the blacks in North America specifically were dominated by British people, what kind of name could you possibly have that would start with the letter X? I thought that was just incredible. Her insight and perception, just from looking at MX on his briefcase, facilitated all that he talked about. Thought that was just incredible. Going into what Dr. Mumbi talked about, the fact that when black people spoke their indigenous African languages, we spoke, when she talked about Germanic languages, which English is one of them, not being a rhythmic language, what she's talking about is tone. African languages are known as tonal languages. So it's how you speak the word and what tones you use, the intonation in speaking the word, where the meaning becomes evident. Whereas in American English and in British English, it's the context in which you use the word. So like you might have a word like weather, meaning the weather outside, and weather, meaning whether or not I want to go somewhere. The reason the words sound the same, they're spelled differently, but they sound exactly the same. The only reason you would know the meaning is because of the context. If I say, "What's the temperature outside today? What's the weather going to be like?" You know that that means the actual weather. If I say, "I'm not sure if whether or not I should go to the store right now or go to see my friend real quick before I go to the store," then you know that I'm trying to make a decision on what I need to do. In the African languages, you might have two words that sound the same, but it's the tone that you use it in that sets the meaning. So you could have a word like, I'm just going to use the English word because people would be more familiar with those, a word like level. And level could mean multiple things. It could mean having something flat and straight, or having something, or reaching a particular level, okay? And let's say in the African language, it might be level, and level means to have something that's on a flat plane. And then they might say it level. And when I use it in that term, level, then that would mean the other level, meaning reaching a particular plateau. So it's the tone in which you speak it that dictates the meaning. And these ways of using tones and intonation has a profound effect on the brain and how it works. And African people and all other people who speak tonal languages, which are non-Western languages, a lot of the other groups in China, they have a tonal language. Japan has a tonal language. And they've even made linguistic connections between Chinese and the Yoruba language. As well as their oracle system. The I Ching oracle system is a direct replica of the Ifa oracle, the 16 cowrie shell oracle. They both have 256 answers you can get. It's real deep and intricate, but they found very intimate connections between these two cultures. Now, that's what she's talking about, and that's one thing that I learned in initiation, that when you speak in English, it locks you into a left brain thinking, which is an analytic, separatist, more conducive to white supremacy mindset. Whereas African languages are more unifying. and they're more about bringing abstract concepts together to make something holistic out of it, rather than breaking them down to separate them into their, you know, most minuscule parts to dissect and analyze them. That is the complete antithesis. And when we would do our meditations in my spiritual practice, and you would chant these comedic words, you're speaking them in tone, and it causes certain vibrations in your skull as you're mouthing these words. And as you do so, those vibrations actually allow blood flow to parts of the brain that normally don't get them. So over time, you can actually grow your brain by doing these meditative practices using the tones of saying these specific comedic terms and words and things like that. So it kind of fosters a more holistic and collective form of thinking rather than a separatist and analytical form of thinking. And that is exactly what she's talking about, especially with English. One thing I've learned about English too is there's a lot of concepts, thoughts, and ideas that exist in other people's languages, even in Spanish, that don't exist in English. So there's certain things that we experience that we have no words, terms, or concepts in the English language to actually voice those things. But in other languages, they're able to do so because they have the words and the different ways of expressing themselves, that things that we might not even have the English words to say, they'll be able to say it in their language and we wouldn't get it. And that's happened to me a couple of times. So I'm just saying that from experience. And it actually happened to me in Spanish. When I was dealing with my godson, my one of my best friends and my partner I used to rhyme with, we were doing the ceremony and he had used a term, I think it was called bendición. And there was a response he had gotten from the priest that was presiding over the ceremony. And I asked him to break down what it meant, and he couldn't explain it to me in English. He said, yo, there's no words in English that I could actually use. But then he tried to give me a more abstract understanding, and I understood that it was pretty much a form of a blessing, and there's a certain type of response, and that response means something, but there was no words in the English language that he could actually use to explain it to me where it would make sense. So that was just a personal experience with the Spanish language as Dominican people speak it. So that's just one. Now, the cognitive, let me go back to it, because my internet has been acting a total fool tonight. I just can't even begin to tell you. The cognitive
trade-off
hypothesis. Now, what that is discussing is that at one point in the history of human beings as we developed on this planet, we had a common ancestor with what was known as chimpanzees. And at one point in history, probably around 6 million years ago, but they say it could be anywhere between 6 and 10 million because of the different bones they're finding and all of these other, and how genetics is working. But anyway, what it was that this common ancestor split off into two branches. One became what's known as the hominin branch, which is the branch that we know as the human family. And hominin is spelled H-O-M-O-N-I-N. And then you had the other one that branched off into chimpanzees. So there was this common ancestor and they dwelled in the trees, and that genetically they started to break off. One became more powerful. If you know chimpanzees, they have the strength of 10 human adult males. That's how they're able to rip people's arms right out the sockets and like tear people to shreds, because they're literally, their strength is that of 10 human beings. And the ones who became hominins were the actual weaker of the two. And the chimps chased them out of the trees, which forced them into the savannah. Now, in the savannah, you had to deal with predators like lions. You had to deal with rogue hippos. Hippos kill more people on the African continent than any other animal. You had the water buffalo, which is known to gore people, gore animals in general, and any animal it perceives as a threat. They can actually mob you and kill you. They have like military strategy that they use and all kinds of stuff. So in this environment where there were no trees to climb into, they had to learn to communicate with each other in order for them to convey abstract concepts and also the ability to write in order to pass on knowledge that would help other people, their descendants in that environment, survive. And with that, basically, as that part of the brain began to develop to give us the skills to survive in the savannah, our short-term memory disappeared, because the chimps still retain their short-term memory. So they can look at something, and in less than 2 seconds, they can memorize any pattern. And that's what they were showing. Like in less than 2 seconds, you saw it, Jenna, when they took the numbers off the screen, it was super fast.
Yeah, I was.
And the chimp was able to punch those buttons in 1 second. And we as people would struggle with that short-term memory, because we are no longer dealing with predators in a direct manner. Like the Asian doctor was saying, you know, the chimpanzee needed to quickly count if they're walking into an area occupied by other chimpanzees, how many enemies do I need to fight? So they needed to quickly look, take a glance and be able to say there's 20 of them here. I know that we have 30, so we could go in there because there's 10 more of us than them and we could actually kick their behind. And that happens all the time between chimp groups. They kill each other for territory. So we didn't need that skill anymore. We needed a skill on how to deal with different types of predators that dwelled in the savannah. And that's what created the use of language that shrunk our immediate short-term photographic memory and created this long-term memory and the ability to speak language. Our vocal cords changed. And instead of us just making, you know, grunting sounds, we were able to start formulating words. And that shifted the entire consciousness of humanity is what they're talking about, which kind of relates to what Dr. Mumbi was saying and the whole idea that speaking Western languages have locked us off to total parts of ourselves that we used to have access to that gave us way more perception and ability to understand things in the world on a deeply intimate level than we're able to do it today in this regimented artificial environment because we live in cities and we have no contact with nature like that, like we used to. So that kind of goes into the spiritual stuff I wanted to talk about. Now, there's because when she talked about us being able to communicate telepathically, there's an article that I've talked about numerous times and I posted it in BTR community before, and it deals with a white explorer by the name of Patrick Bowen. And he had gone to South Africa in like the late 1800s, early 1900s. And he met this South African Kemetic priest. And he was of a group known as Bonabakumu Abasekemu. And that means the people from of old who belong to the priesthood of Oset in Kemet. So basically, these people were South African, but they were a part of the Nile Valley complex and they migrated to South Africa and they still practice those spiritual traditions that used to be practiced in the Nile. And Mankanyezi told Bowen that there's a priest in every ethnic group across the African continent and that they're a secret brotherhood and that he predicted that Bowen weeks later would come in contact with another elder brother of his named Manlalanga. And he told him Manlalanga, they have never met physically, but they know each other intimately. And he had taught him some rudimentary spiritual practices. And at one point he had told Mankanyezi, he was sitting there talking to him in nature and he saw a lizard on a branch and he looked at the lizard and the lizard just looked at him sitting on the branch. And after a few minutes, Bowen said that he noticed that Mankanyezi and the lizard's breathing was rhythmic. They were both breathing in and out at the same time and in the same frequency. And after a few seconds, Mankanyezi held his hand out gently to the lizard and it crawled on his hand. And he brought the lizard to him and he said, you would look at something like this and call it witchcraft. But he said, this is just basic skill. The ability to mentally communicate with animals is a basic skill when you get into this brotherhood. And then he gently put the lizard back in the tree. It looked back at him briefly, and then it went on about its business. And he then said to him, again, you're going to meet my elder brother. We have never met in the flesh, but we know each other intimately. We've had many conversations in the astral plane. So Bowen took this as, you know, okay, he's telling me this. We'll see what happens. But he had some insight that there was something special about Manlalanga. So weeks later, Mankanyezi. So weeks later, he meets Manlalanga, the guy who he predicted he would meet. And he literally said, where Manlalanga was located, there's a big gorge that is humanly impossible to get over unless you have a helicopter. So there's no way that it was physically possible that they ever met each other in the flesh. But yet the conversations he had with Manlalanga let him know that just like Mankanyezi told him weeks earlier, that they knew each other quite intimately. And it blew his mind. And he actually asked Manlalanga to further initiate him into the tradition, which he did a little bit, but he ended up, you know, having to move on or whatever. And that's just one of many examples of just what they would call like the basic ability in this tradition. Now, I know for me personally, there's a guy I used to know in Jersey City, and me and him used to rhyme together. We spent a lot of time together and we were really, really close. And he would do this with me and I would do this with him. And when we would tell each other, we would laugh our behinds off. I would wake up on a Sunday, go into the store to get something. My son was a baby, to go get milk or Pampers or whatever the case may be. And I would say, yo, I need to talk to World today. His name was World B. So I said, I need to talk to World today. I hope I bump into him. I walk out my building and who's turning the corner but World? And he says, yo, son, I was just saying I need to talk to you, son. And here you are. And he said, this happens to me all the time. And I said, I do the same thing. If I need to talk to you, I'll just think it. And every single time, without fail, either I would show up with him or he would show up with me. And this was in the beginning stages of my spiritual practice when I transitioned from the Rasta tradition into the Kemetic tradition. And it became like a game we would play where we would just conjure each other up and it would work like a charm every time. So this is just a basic thing, but it'll go into more deeper things. And I'll end up posting the article again so people can read it, because it's actually a firsthand account of a white explorer telling his experiences in South Africa. Now, I just want to find, this is a book called The Iceman Inheritance by a man named Michael Bradley. It's a great book that I think black people should read. It's The Iceman Inheritance, Prehistoric Sources of Western Man Sexism and Aggression. And this guy goes into the history of how white people became racist and sexist due to their isolation in Europe and the psychosocial pathology that was developed in a cold environment with no resources. But in this book, he discusses what some of our abilities. So here we go. This is on page 54. It may be worth mentioning here that, and when he uses the term capoid, that was a scientific term in the up until like the 70s into the 80s that was used to describe different branches of mankind. So the capoids were people from the Cape of Africa or South Africa, known as the Khoisan people. And they're known as sometimes Bushmen. So he says, it may be worth mentioning here that with capoids, human potential may have taken a somewhat unique direction, a direction which would be precious today and whose loss is bitter. Vanderpost, which was told by several different Kalahari tribesmen that the Bushmen could, quote unquote, speak the baboon's language until about a century ago, but no longer, and that they used to be able to communicate with many other animals and plants. Vanderpost saw no reason to doubt this assertion, and neither do I, especially considering recent experiments with such diverse creatures as dolphins and philodendrons, which indicate a sentience of some sort. All peoples have preserved legends about a time of human-animal communication, but the capoid tradition seems both recent and more vital. The white man's way of doing things, as illustrated by our cumbersome experiments with dolphins and dolphin communication, and our shock at discovering philodendron sentience, appears to be significantly inferior when compared to capoid ability. So they're saying that there was a time when they used to speak the baboon's language. Now, if you know about the Bushmen people, they are one of the groups that speak with clicks. And they use, I believe they have about 7 different clicks they use, and they use them in combination with actual words, and they'll have clicks intertwined in the words, or they'll just have the clicks that mean individual things depending on the context of how they use it. And if you know about baboons, they communicate in clicks. And they had an ability to directly communicate with baboons, which is something that used to happen on the Nile Valley all the time. In the temples of Tahuti, they would keep sacred baboons. And they would have communication with them, and they would adorn them and treat them as supreme beings, because they were the nature's symbolic representation of the deity that created writing, and actually is in charge of human intelligence. His name is Tahuti. One of his symbols is the ibis. The other symbol is the baboon, amongst others. But those are the two main ones. And what it is that there was a tradition. That's where you think Tarzan came from. Tarzan, that whole ability for Tarzan, and all that animal communication, they got that from Africans they saw doing that. So nothing they do is based on some, they just imagined something really lofty. No, they saw our people doing that. I talked about the honey god, which the people of Kenya, the Maasai and other ethnic groups, it's a bird that sometimes comes to them and gets their attention. It literally communicates with them, or they go and find it, because they have honey. It's held at a high premium, anything sweet, because it gives you a burst of energy in a natural environment where you don't eat candy and processed foods. So anything that's sweet will give you energy that they use to you know, live their daily lives. And honey is one of those things that come at a high premium because it's a natural antibiotic, because they can use it to sweeten things, and because it gives that burst of energy. So the bird will come and make sounds at the people, and they will end up following the bird. The bird guides them to a beehive, and the Maasai will climb that tree, take the honey that they need. They always leave enough for the bees. They never take everything. And then they take some of the honeycomb specifically for the honey god as payment for the bird helping them find honey. And it still happens to this day. You can look it up on YouTube. There's documentaries that were done by National Geographic on it. You can go to, and I forget where in Africa this happens, but I know that in Brazil it happens, where you have fishermen that call dolphins out from the sea. And the dolphins will come in and herd fish onto the shore for them. And they will collect all of the fish without having to hop in a boat and go out in the ocean and cast nets. The dolphin does all the work. They chase the fish into the shore. The men throw their nets out right there on the shore, drag the fish in, and then they give dolphins, they toss them fish, a certain number of fish as payment, thanking them for helping them collect fish. Still happens to this day. They also have documentaries about that too, and you can look them up on YouTube. They've done it on National Geographic and the Discovery Channel.
Yeah, I done seen some of those.
So there are abilities that we had when we practiced our own traditions and we lived in a natural way that we no longer have at all. That book by Michael Bradley just discussed the known fact that our ancestors communicated with animals. Now we're going to go into some other stuff. And this has to do with just the some more of these spiritual abilities that we're missing that are just kind of incredible when you think about it. Let me pull this up real quick. You are now live on Real Life, the radio show with myself, Rod, and my co-host, Jenna Kepra. Thanks for being with us this evening. If you wish to call in and ask a question or make a comment, please call us at 719-284-5271, and the code is 70637. Again, that's 719-284-5271. And the code is 70637. Press star 61 if you wish to ask a question or make a comment, and please watch the background noise. I'm not hearing you too much.
Can you hear me?
I hear you now.
Okay, my fault. I think we're going to have a continuation of this because I know you have a whole lot of examples that you want to get out. And we've been talking about this.
We'll continue it. I'll just talk about a couple of them right now, and then I want to just get into the ancestors a little bit. I just think this is important because there are principles in nature that exist in the human, in Black people and people, but most potently in Black people specifically. And we go by in our ancestral practices can have intimate relationships with these supreme beings that you can't see with the eye, but make themselves manifest based on the things that they control in nature. And when you are able to go through that initiatic process, it facilitates the initiation of the most intimate personal relationship that you could ever have with the Supreme Being. The same way you talk to your mom and dad and your best friend and whoever else, you can literally get responses from the spirit world like that when you go through those processes. And it's really interesting. So I'm just going to go through two different things right now. One is going to deal with the beneficence of this energy. Last time we talked about this, we talked about Nihenny Whippler and her intimate relationship with Shango and how Shango had saved her life when she was in a dire emergency, and her and the person who was driving her, who was...
Yeah, with the lightning.
Died. Go ahead.
With the lightning.
With the lightning. She was able to call the lightning, and the lightning showed up and literally lit a path for her to escape a ravine and get the medical attention for her close friend who was taking her to this college party. So this one is dealing with a different situation. This is dealing with a woman whose child drowned in Puerto Rico. And I'm going to let them tell the story. I'm reading the book. This is The Santeria Experience by Nihenny Gonzalez Whippler. This is on page 8 in the book.
What's the book name again?
It's called The Santeria, or I say it the Spanish way, Santeria Experience by Nihenny, and that's Migene Gonzalez, Gonzalez, hyphen Whippler, Wippler. And she started her initiatic process into the Orisha tradition or Ifa tradition of the Yoruba people in Puerto Rico at the age of like 5 or 6 years old with her nanny, who was a black Puerto Rican from Arecibo, Puerto Rico, which is still a black area in Puerto Rico today. These people were directly transported from Nigeria, or what they call Yoruba land, to Puerto Rico. And they maintained their traditions from the continent till this very day. So let me just read this real quick. She says, Maria used to tell me that the presence of Yemaya is always much stronger in very deep waters. Off the north coast of Puerto Rico, in an area known as Bronson's Deep, the ocean floor plunges down to 27,000 feet. Measured from this depth, the mountains of Puerto Rico would be among the highest in the world, with an approximate height of 31,500 feet. Anything that falls within these waters is lost forever, says the legend, unless Yemaya is offered a prize in exchange for her bounty. Truly, her demands are modest. 7 shiny copper pennies, a bit of sugarcane syrup, and sometimes a few candies are enough to please her. Perhaps it's not the value of the gift that Yemaya really wants, but the faith with which it was given. In these same waters, just pay attention because this story is kind of crazy. It'll seem crazy, but for people who are involved in this tradition, it's not crazy at all. In these same waters on August 16th, 1977, off the coast of San Juan, so this is a reported incident in the papers, an incident took place in which a fully reported in the San Juan Star. For several weeks, I had been in one of those hotels lining the El Condado Avenue, working against the deadline on one of my books. One afternoon, a friend went snorkeling in the deep waters off the San Juan coast, and when he returned several hours later, he had a tragic story to tell. A family from the nearby Santo Domingo had come to visit Puerto Rico for the first time. Their 13-year-old son disregarded the warnings of the dangerous undercurrents surrounding the coast of San Juan, and the great depth of the waters. He swam out far from the shore, probably too weak to fight against the currents. The boy suddenly sank under the water and did not surface again. Local lifeguards and members of the police rescue squad tried to locate his body, but all of their efforts proved fruitless. The story spread through El Condado, and all of the hotels sent out search parties to find the body. The boy's mother was determined not to leave her son's body in the sea, as she wanted to bring it back to Santo Domingo for a proper burial. But late in the afternoon of the following day, the authorities called off the search. All desperate entreaties of the boy's mother fell on deaf ears. The police were sure the powerful undercurrents in these waters had driven the body down toward the ocean floor and wedged it on one of the reef's many underwater crevices. Now you're talking 27,000 feet. But the mother asked to go along with the search party on the very last search. She pleaded with them. If the body was not found during this last search, she would not insist any further. After some consideration, the authorities agreed. As the story unfolded in the San Juan Star, she brought along with her 4 white candles. When the boat had gone sufficiently out to sea, she asked the officers to stop the engine. Here, she felt, they would find her son's body. More to humor her than for any other reason, the rescue squad officers stopped the boat's engine. The mother then approached the boat's gunwale and began an impassioned plea to the sea. Kneeling on the deck, her hands linked together in prayer, tears streaming down her face, she called out to the sea to return her son's body to her. Reminding the sea that the boy was dead, she proposed that it exchange his body for the candles she had brought along. Since four candles are burned around the coffin, these also represented her dead son. As she spoke, she pulled the candles from her handbag and threw them overboard. A few minutes later, the rescue squad officers aboard the boat watched aghast as the boy's body surfaced on the same spot where the candle had sunk in the water. Had Maria been aboard that boat, she would not have been at all surprised. Without any doubt, she would have stated that Yemaya, the great supernal mother, had taken pity on another mother and had accepted the exchange willingly and with her blessing. As to the apparent cruelty of the sea in taking the boy's life, Maria would have probably answered that the sea had been kind, saving him from a life of suffering and giving him eternal life instead. Maria held the view that life was an illusion, so for that matter was death. It's just another way of life, Lorisita, she would say, a far better way of life. So this woman, even though they were going to call off the search, they had desperately searched for her son, she knew of Yemaya, also known as Olokun. That's the same deity that resides in the deep ocean. That's one of the three major primordial deities of the Yoruba tradition. And she left an offering that was a symbolic representation of her son, pleading to the deity of the ocean to please release her son's body. And right on the spot where she put those candles out, her son's body came back up. And that's a true story. It was documented in the San Juan Star newspaper in Puerto Rico. And there's quite a few stories like that when it comes to this tradition that are quite mind-blowing. So there's one. The other one has to do with incurring the wrath of one of the Orisha. This one deals with Oshun. Oshun is the deity in charge of the river. She's also the deity in charge of gold and copper. She's also the deity that is one of her main implements is a mirror, and she's extremely beautiful. The mother type archetype is Yemaya, and Oshun is more of the beauty of the woman and the facilitation of conception. But Yemaya is the gestation of conception. This is in the spiritual tradition. So this is a story about someone who irked, who incurred her wrath and how that worked out. And this is also a true story that she bore witness to. Okay, so she said, let me see.
This located in the same book, Russ.
Yes, it's in the same book. This is on page 59, actually. So she said, sometimes they call her Yeye Kari, and she loves to dance and to paint herself. She's always looking at herself in the mirror and loves perfumes and pretty clothes. Men are crazy about her, and she plays with them all the time and makes them do whatever she wants. Here, Maria rolls her eyes and heaved a great sigh. There are many mysteries with the saints, Floricita, and with Oshun, especially. She be many women and still be herself only. I like Oshun very much, I said. She's a very happy Orisha. That she is, Floricita, that she may be, Maria said gravely, but she can be very serious when she has to, and it's very dangerous to make her angry. She don't forgive as easy as Yemaya. Many Santeros, and Santeros are priests of the Santeria tradition, have confirmed Maria's pronouncement on the dangers of offending the usually happy and charming Oshun. A now famous story illustrating this Orisha's delicate sensibilities has been reported by many Ialochas, which are female initiates or mothers of different houses of the tradition. And it seems that a Gilmir was given in Havana in honor of Oshun, and one of her children became possessed by the saint, who very promptly wrapped herself in a yellow silk mantle and began to circulate among the guests. Never had Yeye Kari been happier and more flirtatious. She laughed and joked and swung the fringes of her mantle from side to side with her inimitable sauciness. No one could have been more feminine and seductive, even though she was occupying a man's body. Now you're talking about possession. Now each deity has both male and female adherents that are initiated into specific deities. Oshun being the ultimate feminine character, when she possesses her male initiates, they begin to act feminine like she does. So this is what she's describing. So it says, although she was occupying a man's body, one of those at the party reached out an irreverent hand and slapped the backside of the possessed Omo Oshun, which means child of Oshun, and jeeringly accused him of being an invertido, which is a homosexual. So he basically called him a faggot. His action froze everyone in the room, which became cold and silent. Oshun stopped dead in her tracks. Very slowly, she turned to face the man who had insulted her. Looking at him hard and long, she said, five Irole for you and five Irole for my Omo Orisha. Irole means day in Yoruba. Five is Oshun's adjudicated number in Santeria. None of those present at the Gilnir was unduly surprised when both Oshun's son and the man who had offended her died 5 days later of the same intestinal trouble. The entire abdominal region is sacred to Oshun in the human body. Perhaps the most frightening part of the story is that both men were buried the same day. Their graves coincidentally were side by side. 25 Ialichas, all daughters of Oshun, all possessed by the Ialicha, showed up at the burial. All during the service, they stood by the graveside laughing in a low, tenebrous tone with a curiously mirthless and contemptuous laughter. Many of the stories about the dangers of offending the Venus of the Yorubas are told by the Santeros, who say Oshun is most frightening when she laughs. It'd be better when she cries, Florecita Maria used to tell me. Anytime she cries, she's happy with you and will give you what you want. But why, Maria? Oshun be very sentimental, very passionate, feelings very strong. Alogura, she cries when she be happy and laughs when she be sad. She also laughs at the parties when she is not angry, I argued. She said, that be different, smiled Maria, patting my hand. Nothing deep there, no feeling involved. You still have much to learn, Florecita, but you learn. So this was an incident where the deity was offended. And her number in the Yoruba tradition, the Orisha tradition, is five. Both of them died 5 days later. She's in charge of the intestines. And they died of the same intestinal affliction. And they were buried the same day, side by side. And like she said, dozens of the people at the funeral were daughters of Oshun, and they all were possessed by Oshun at the same time, and all of them were laughing at both of them as they were placed in the grave.
Wow.
So imagine you're at a funeral, and you see all these people dressed in yellow and red, which is Oshun's colors, and these are all initiates. And they're laughing contemptuously at the people being buried due to them offending the Orisha who possessed all 125 of them, I think they said, that showed up to the funeral, to the burial, I should say. So again, we're talking about these intimate relationships with these beings that you cannot see with the naked eye, but they control certain parts of the human body because they dwell within us, and they control aspects of nature. And they make themselves felt in both ways. She's also in charge of money and riches. So a lot of times if people are struggling financially, they will petition Oshun to try and open their paths and doors and roads to getting money that they need for whatever purpose they need, if it's for something important or whatever the case may be. She's also in charge of gold as well as copper. So these are just a couple of stories here that kind of elucidate just how powerful these deities are, and the fact that one human being, I've always discussed the Kemetic proverb that talks about, they compare the all, or the creator, or as we call it, Patem Ta, which means the all, to an ocean of consciousness, and each human being is a single drop out of the consciousness of that ocean. And the fact that we have the same abilities as the all, but on a smaller scale because we're individual units out of that ocean. So when the deity possesses their initiate, they can possess thousands of people at one time because one human being is too small a vessel to encompass an entire aspect of nature. That's how you could have 125 people at a funeral all possessed by the same deity. And in some cases, it's thousands of them, depending on the ceremony you go to and how many people show up at our initiate.
Now, are these the only beings that's... Because I imagine that you say they all was initiates, so they are given in to this said being, correct?
Yes, what it is that you go through a ceremony where you're sequestered for a certain number of days, and then usually you become a new initiate for at least a year. During that year, you're supposed to wear all white. They shave your head bald in the Orisha tradition, and you're not supposed to look at mirrors in order to keep you from being vain. You're never supposed to look in the mirror. You're supposed to shave your head. Your hair is a sacrifice to the Orisha. And then what they do, remember I told you that there's multiple kinds of education that we used to have on the continent? Mm-hmm. You had the book education, where you go into a classroom type setting and you have a teacher lecturing to a group of students, and they might take notes. Then you have what they do is they'll take you out into nature and then show you what you learned in class as it shows itself in nature. So you can actually learn by direct observance. That's where hieroglyphics and the development of hieroglyphics came from. It's learning to read nature. And what they teach you in class, they show you how it plays out in nature. Then you have another way of being educated, and that's what they call pouring knowledge into a person. So they don't have to go through X number of days of education. It's like opening a cosmic DNA bank that directly connects you to this particular deity. And all of that deity's powers are fused through the crown of your head into your spirit, or also known as your Ori. Your Ori is your individual guardian angel that resides with all of us from the day we're born to the day that we die. It's an aspect of ourselves that resides in the crown of the head. So they pour this information into you, and as a result, you end up tapping into the abilities of that particular deity. You can do it when you're not possessed or when you're possessed, but when you're possessed is when it's most powerful, because at that point, your waking consciousness as Jenna disappears. It is supplanted and completely pressed down and taken over by the deity itself. So people who are possessed by Shango will be able to eat fire. They'll take coals, hot coals out of a barbecue, put it in their mouth, not get burnt at all, chew it up and swallow it and have no injuries. Ogun people are known to take machetes and try to slice themselves on their arms and never get cut. And this is documented. White people have even gone to Africa and seen that. That's what attracted Hillary and Bill Clinton. A lot of people don't know that Hillary and Bill, when he wanted to win his second presidency, he actually went to Haiti and went to a high priest that they were dealing with for many years and had him do a ritual to ensure that he would become president for that second term. That's also documented. I remember, I think it was ABC News or somebody had actually followed them down there and did like an interview. Yes. So these white people know about it and they use this stuff all the time. They just don't let you know that they're using it. And then they scare you when you go to some Western religious institutions. They scare you into thinking what your ancestors did was devil worship, while some of the most prominent white people are going to your people to ask for the intercession of these same primordial deities. Because they know the power of these things. Matter of fact, a lot of people don't know that Fidel Castro was an initiate. That is how it is said that he avoided over 360 assassination attempts by the CIA. And there's a couple of really powerful stories about how he narrowly escaped death, and it was all attributed to his relationship with Exu. One thing that was said about him was that he was known to wear two watches, and everybody wondered why he would wear the two watches. And it's because on one of his hands, he had his beads that were dedicated to Exu, and he did not want them to be exposed to others, so he would cover it with his watch.
Okay, look, we at the end of the show, so I'm going to ask you this. And I know we're going to need some more time, because you got a lot of information you've been wanting to get out, so I'm going to just sit back and take the information in as well. But before we leave, I'm sure there's a lot of people that want to know, how are these white people taking these African deities and using their power when we can't use it right now? Answer that, close out the show, and we'll discuss on how we're going to fix this up for next week.
No problem. Now, how they've been doing it is this. For a long time, in certain parts of the African continent, and it kind of spread over here too with the people they brought during the transatlantic slave trade, there was a rule against not initiating non-African people. And over time, there were certain high priests that decided that it was okay to initiate non-African people. So as a result, you have some black people who will initiate white people. they do exactly what the Greeks have done as far as like not fully understanding the tradition, because white people are naturally left brain people, and over 85% of them have calcified pineal glands. So their ability to interpret these things is not always correct, because they, in other words, they learn what they can and they do the best with what they learn. But with what they learn, they're able to do quite a bit. I'll put it like that. And that's how they tap into it. With black people, you have what's known as alleles, and alleles are people who are not initiated, but they're adherents of the tradition. And these are regular people. They might be Christian or Catholic, and they might practice a syncretic version of the tradition, which is known as Santeria in Puerto Rico, Candomblé in Brazil, or Lucumi in Cuba. And what it is that they'll go to a Babalawo, which is a high priest of the Orisha tradition, or to a Santero, which is an initiate into and a priest into of one of the different deities, and they'll go to them for spiritual counseling whenever they have problems or need help or intercession of the deity. They have specific initiates they go to and get readings done, which will help them navigate their lives, whether or not they should buy this particular house. Is it a bad omen for them to buy this house? If they're having trouble finding a job, they'll go and seek intercession on how to go about what spiritual rituals they need in order to find a job. And the priest will do what they need to do as far as doing the reading, getting the information directly from the ancestors or from a specific deity, and then telling them, this is what you need to do. And if you follow these instructions, your paths and doors and roads will be open to that particular job you're looking for. And it happens all the time. If you don't follow what they say, then either nothing happens or sometimes worse things can happen to you. It all depends on what the prognosis is. So what it is that the reason why it hasn't been working to the benefit of black people in America is because most black people in America tend to shy away from it. We've been taught that it's devil worship and it's evil and it's magic and it's all of these things, when in reality, it is the foundation of what became Christianity.
All right. Let's hold right there. Mm-hmm. Let's hold right there. And, you give your thoughts on tonight's show and close us on out, because we're gonna continue right there at that point next week.
No problem. My take is this: I like I said, anyone's relationship to their supreme being or creator is the most intimate and personal thing. So it's never to downplay or disrespect anyone's religious practice, whatever religion you may practice or whatever it is you may believe in or not believe in. That's up to you. But know that there is a system that dates back to the earliest annals of us as humans on the African continent before we spread around the world. And these are the oldest spiritual traditions on earth. And the main thing that the difference between what our ancestors practiced in its ideal and most positive form was this. Religion was unseen science, and science was the seen aspect of religion. So in other words, they're two aspects of the same thing. One is a mirror image of the other. That's why when you deal with these traditions, you'll find that these priests were not just priests, that some of them were doctors, they were herbalists, they were warriors. So they had multiple disciplines. They were multidisciplinary masters, most of them. It was never just one thing that they were excellent at or mastered. They have multiple skills. And what it is that in the Western hemisphere, Western religions, these are things that they don't really show you, or they'll demonize it when it's African, but yet these same practices have happened or are documented in Christianity. So they'll tell you, like, you're not supposed to do readings or things like that, but yet in the Bible, you have something known as casting lots, which is the Israeli oracle. The difference between their oracle and the Orisha oracle is that the Orisha oracle can tell you intimate details about yourself, meaning things that happen to you, things that only you and the creator know that you've never shared with anyone else, that will come out in the reading with the right priest, and you go there and get it done. You will hear things about yourself that you thought nobody else knew. With the Israeli oracle casting lots, it can only give you a yes or no answer. So before they would go into battle or before they would have certain major events, they would consult their oracle by casting lots, and it would tell them either yes or no. So is it auspicious for us to do this on this day? It'll tell them yes or no. Is this going to work out for us? Yes or no. Everything is yes or no, and that's it. But yet, when it's presented in, let's say, a church or a synagogue or a mosque, they'll say that this stuff is wicked. But yet, right in the Bible, the same thing is being done in a different capacity, but it's the same thing. You know, they'll say that veneration of ancestors is worshiping the dead. We don't worship the dead. We venerate them. And when you go through Christianity, isn't Jesus an ancestor? Wasn't Mary supposed to be an ancestor? So there's a form, a clandestine forms of ancestral worship that you experience in these traditions. They're just not codified and expressed as such for their practitioners to understand it. And when you get into dealing with your ancestors, then it's a more intimate relationship because these people are genetically related to you. They're the reason you look like you look. They're the reason you have the personality traits you have. They're the reason you have a lot of the life experiences you have. And we're just not taught that the same relationship you have with your parents, you should have with your ancestors. The difference is they may not communicate the same way that we do, but they do communicate. And if you're not prepared for it, it can terrify people. You might smell a perfume your grandmother used to wear all the time. That means your grandmother's there. Nobody sprayed the perfume, but the scent is there and it's heavy, as if somebody just sprayed it in the air. That's happened to my mother numerous times in her house. She'll be there, she'll be, you know, doing her prayers on a Sunday or Saturday, and all of a sudden she'll smell the perfume that my grandmother used to wear, and it would smell like intense. Would happen to her all the time. Before my son was born, my wife had a visitation. My son, she said, came to her, we were sleeping, and she said it was a golden image of a baby, looked just like my son with an afro. He was born with an afro, light-skinned little baby, sitting on the bed, and she said she felt an impression as if somebody was literally physically sitting on the bed, but it was this baby who visited her before my son was born. And once she had the C-section and he was born, she said that was the baby that came to me in that visitation before my son came into the world. These are personal experiences of mine. She's had these things happen with her grandmother before, where her grandmother would, she'll be having certain problems or dealing with certain issues, and her grandmother would literally come to her in a dream. I remember one time she told me she was sitting in the park, her grandmother was there, and everything that she was dealing with, her grandmother discussed with her in the dream. And then in an abstract proverbial type of language, gave her the answer to the problem that she sought. So these are things you personally experience. And that is something that as you get into it, it becomes more evident that there's more to life than what we know and more to life than what we may be informed of when we go to, when we practice certain forms of spirituality that do not acknowledge these realities. When you start to acknowledge those realities and they respond to you, and you start seeing those responses and feeling them and sensing them and reaping the benefits of these connections, then it becomes something that makes more sense to you. And then it's like, okay, so now I understand there's a whole other aspect to my life that I've been ignoring. And parts of that is some of those abilities come with it. So with that, I know that we're creeping up on the hour. So did you have any other questions, Jenna, before we get ready to close out?
Nah, I was just going to leave them up to next week. I'm going to get you right back on this.
Okay.
On this specific question, but we have a caller before we cut out tonight. Caller, what's your name? Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from New Jersey. This is Miss Sharon. How are you, brothers?
Greetings.
How are you?
Okay. I've been listening for 3 weeks. This is my third week. Okay. Are you talking about the ancestors tonight?
Well, now I am, yes. Go ahead.
Okay, and you also had a tape of David Banner?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, we played
I just wanted to be sure. I'm sorry. That's the only reason I'm calling this late. I wanted to be sure I was on point. I have been listening this tonight, last week, and the week before. So I wanted you brothers to know that. And you are, you're on point about the ancestors. You know, I don't know everything, but you are on point. I enjoy David Banner. I could resonate with what, you know, he thinks about the whole thing.
Yeah.
So that's what I wanted to say. And I also wanted to greet Brother Tenner and you. Okay. All right, guys.
So
you're doing a good,
business,
good. You're doing a wonderful job. I refused to call in last week or the week before because I was waiting to let some other people call in. but
okay,
you know, you're doing a wonderful job, you know, for our melanated people.
Well, know that you can call in anytime. It's not a problem. I just didn't know if you had any questions about what you were hearing, or if you might have had any experiences regarding that sort of stuff that you might want to share, even if it's one experience before.
Well, yeah, I have, because having an African grandmother, and I did have a question for you. That's why I know it is true. And if you look at our colonizers, if you go back to the tape on the eights, well, you know, your pet peeve is codification. So that's really what's happening, something that we lack as a people. Yeah. And, you know, I do codify, but many of us don't. And that's how they came up with the movie Dr. Doolittle.
Yes.
They stole that from us.
They see these things. Yeah. And then they make it entertaining. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Like it's theirs. Like, you know, they claim it. Like it belongs to them. And of course, we knew no better at that time, most of us. And when you talk about the aura, I'm not sure. I don't think you used the word aura, but the word aura is coming from that specific segment when you said there, you know, what comes out of a crown of her head. I was taught some of these things by my grandmother because she was African. So these experiences are true. They do happen. But the question I have is it a bad thing if a bloodline seems to have fortune? You know, can the ancestor request that from Oshun? Is that a bad thing? I mean, is that considered evil? Because, you know, there are people who are quick to say, you know, you did something, that's why, you know, they're this or that. Now, I understand there's an ethnic group that uses Kabbalah. Okay, what's the difference? Yes. That's, you know, but is it
it's
a bad thing? Because you spoke
tradition
on gold and copper and those things. Is that, does that mean that the ancestor or Oshun is displeased with that?
That's a great
group of
question.
People? Or
now,
can it be a bad or a good thing?
What it is that it can be bad or good depending on the person.
Okay.
And also you have people who are able to manipulate universal laws. So there's certain laws that govern nature and the universe that the average person doesn't know. If you get into the Kabbalion or the seven hermetic principles, these are the laws that I'm talking about. The principle of gender, the principle of rhythm, all of this, there's seven of them in total that were all written by Tahuti. And some people, even though they might not actually be quote unquote good people, as far as their behavior, they have tapped into manipulating certain laws of nature that allows them to be successful. And then with other people, they don't know how to manipulate those laws. So they are severed from accessing certain things because they don't understand how those laws work. Or if a person is carrying certain ma'ashim, some people will say karmic debt, from whether it's a previous life or from something that
maybe
your ancestors have done, it can sever your access to certain gifts that the Creator might want to bestow upon you. And in a lot of African spiritual traditions, including the one that I practice, your ancestors are considered your lawyers in the world of the dead. So in other words, because they are genetically connected to you, you are a living replica of they who have passed on, and they have lived a human existence.
Yes.
They intercede on your behalf with deities in the world of the dead.
Yes,
so
I know that. Yes, that's
true.
The better
with your ancestors, the better access you have to whatever gifts that the universe, the all, the creator, or any of their subordinate deities wish to bestow upon you. It's like a fast track to getting those gifts. And if you don't have any relationship with your ancestors at all, or if you have one that's subpar, then you find that a lot of people are cut off from accessing those things. Another thing that ancestors can do too is take your life or allow your life to be taken if you are about to destroy the familial legacy. So in other words, if you have a child and that child, you know, is just wayward, they're getting into the street, they're selling drugs, they're shooting people, they're just wilding out. And the ancestors are like, okay, this person is obviously, they've gone rogue. And in order to not allow their karmic debt to have an effect on future descendants, they might create a scenario or allow a scenario to be created in which they're killed.
Yeah.
In order to stop that person where they couldn't stop themselves. So
it's
these types
valuable
of things are
that
all
you're
things
doing
that take
this.
Place.
It's yes. valuable you're doing this, Brother Ross, because, you know, this is a tool that our people should know. It may help them in some of their difficulties in life. You know, absolutely. I was taught to give back, if you're blessed, to give it back, you know, and that's what my family absolutely. Was taught. But knowing, understanding karma and the debt to the universe and to karma and all. So it is it's invaluable. You know, anything that could take us forward, it's important, you know. So you're yeah. doing wonderful, needed work. And, you know, I respect that. And, you know, I do support. I will continue. We do need to, all this, it's a lot of separation. You know, I told you I don't do social media, but some of the things that I look at, some people there, it's like we're on the plantation and people are going at each other for insignificant things. You know, we're supposed to be conscious and seeking some kind of unity. So right. I don't get involved because, you know, I can't have that kind of drama. I'm 63 years old. And then, you know, some of our older people are guilty because they need to progress. And if you know that these platforms are about black melanated consciousness, then you need to stay on point or do not engage. Now, that's it. I call a spade. It's black consciousness. First of all, you need to understand what that really means, because you're getting on there and you're trying to bring something to the table that's not what the chat group, that's not what the platform is about. So I try, you know, I respect that, even though I'm not involved in these rooms, but I respect what you're doing and it is needed, you know.
Well, thank you. I would say if you were looking for a positive social media experience with like-minded black people, join BTR community, because there's nothing but us on there. We don't get into arguing and creating any sort of agitation amongst each other, and we just try to share information and give each other things that we need. And
well, I have quite
there.
A bit to share. Yeah. I have to do it. I've been very busy the past few weeks, but I've still been listening, and I'm not going to procrastinate. I try to keep my word because I think that's important in the universe. But
yeah.
I just wanted you guys to hear from me because I was like, I'm listening.
You.
I am a follower. I am listening. And I, I'm a little behind with shooting an email out to Brother Lance. Well, Quajo. I need to send him an email and just try to uplift him and encourage him, because what he did was really great. And, you know, our people sometimes, they need some fire under them. I mean, this brother went across the continent. It was something he needed to fulfill for himself, but he also did a very, very great thing for the rest of us behind. So, you know, sometimes we just need a little bit too much of a push. And Sister Renetta also, I intend to include her because she's been trying to put out things to take us into a financial way of thinking. And, you know, as I said, I know about these things. That's why I had told you in an email, tell Brother Jenna, you know, things that definitely I've always been involved in the stock market. But our people, they have to, you know, really catch on. I basically prefer being about action, a doer, you know, and some of us, we can fall short with that. So anyway, I want you brothers to have a very good night, and you're doing the work of the ancestors.
We're
going to
get into
the
ancestors next week. We're going to get deeper into the ancestors.
The rest of it.
We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about dark deceit. A lot of people don't know what dark disease are, but we'll get into dark disease.
Okay.
And the things we can do to help those of our ancestors ancestors who may have died on the wrong side of Ma'at, meaning people who had troubled lives and left this planet, and they might actually be causing you discomfort because they're trying to get your attention in order for you to help them transition to a higher level. So we'll talk about some of that next week.
Great. Well, you can tell me what, maybe you can touch on this next week, something that I've done for years when I'm celebrating my children or my grandchildren's birthday. Mm-hmm. I set a place setting for my parents.
Yes.
And my brother who has gone on, and I've just always have done that.
That's powerful.
You know, people think that that's like, you know, crazy and weird and all, but I've
not
always done that. It's always hit an idea. So look, have a wonderful, wonderful, you know, night, and I will look forward to next week.
Thank
you. I'm looking forward to hearing
from you next week too.
Thank you so much. Go ahead, Jenna.
It's going to be a lot of Roz. He's doing all of the teaching these last couple weeks. But we have had a few pop-up sessions. So if you go to BTRnetwork.com, then you could go and set those reminders for whenever we do go live. It'll just pop up as a reminder for you.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah,
well, Brother Jenner, you bring so much to the table. I love when you come in and you have such wisdom. You bring a lot to the table. And I'm sure in the BTR community, you know, more questions, whatever you would want to ask me. So I will make it a point tomorrow to do that. But, you know, between the building of the garden and this, and it's just been hectic. But I will make sure I do this tomorrow, tie up my loose ends. And I'm glad to hear your voice also. All right, brothers. Have a good
Thank you, Michelle.
Peace.
You have a good
peace
one.
Peace and love and protection. Okay.
Yes, love and light to you, sister.
Yes, bye-bye. Peace and love, Michelle. You have a good night.
Okay.
Go on to take us on out of here, Brother Roz. Hit us with the prayer.
All right. Thank you all for spending your Tuesday evening with us. We greatly appreciate each and every one of you. Thank you to Sister Sharon for calling in. Thank you to Brother Otis. I did see you in there. I know you didn't chime in, but it's all good. It's just great to see you there. To all the other calls and listeners, we thank you as well. And to those who may listen to the podcast at a future date, we thank you as well. We greatly appreciate each and every one of you. We're going to actually say the prayer now and close out tonight's show. Creator, we ask that you help us to remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us to remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time that we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Let's replace white supremacy with justice ASAP, and let's end human trafficking and crash and completely destroy the prison industrial complex. I am in the love of the all, and all love is in me. I am a part of the all, and the all is a part of me. I am one with the all, and the all is one with me. I can succeed as a part of the all and fail as an individual. I can be all that I wish in the all, as long as my wish is to stay in the all. I am never alone. The all is, I am. The all can, I can. The all does, I do. Now, if you listen very closely to that prayer, you'll find that it directly coincides with what I discussed, that comedic proverb about each of us being a drop out of the ocean of God, if you know him as God's consciousness. And that's what that prayer is relating to, your direct connection to the all. So I hope that those words really hit you in a deep place and become a part of the essence of who you are, as far as helping you understand who and what you are as a Black person, male, female, child in this world. Thanks again for being with us tonight. We'll see you next week. Creator willing, peace and love, love and light. One love to you all. Thank you.
Peace and love. Thanks for being here with us on this 23rd of May. She's fine. Hey, what's up, yo?
things are said. And you heard what Sharon said. Your insight is so, she likes you. That's what I'm saying. Like, people seeing you if you don't see yourself. They may not